This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive, and it's Name Your Price tool. Say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show coverage options within your budget. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Max Cuevas didn't have it easy growing up. His family and all the families he knew in the little town of Lindsay, California, made their living working in the fields, harvesting citrus fruits.
You're carrying about a 70-pound sack that you're filling with either oranges or lemons, and you're climbing up and down a ladder. Once it's filled, then you go dump it, and then the process starts again.
During the week, Max and his 8 siblings would go to school. Then, on weekends, they would work with their parents. The same was true for all school breaks.
Any holiday, we'd be out there with them. So during the Christmas break, we'd be out there in the fields with my mom and dad.
During their summer break, they would drive up to San Jose, living in tent camps and picking cherries, apricots, and pears until August. Then they would drive south to Fresno for grape season before returning to Lindsay for back to school and the next orange season.
That was the cycle for us, year in, year out.
The work was tough, but their family was close. They spent a lot of time laughing, joking around.
Somehow my mom and dad made it fun.
But then tragedy struck. One of Max's brothers became sick. He was prescribed penicillin and had a severe allergic reaction. A few days later, he died. The whole family was devastated.
Seeing the hurt and the crying, and it was inconsolable. I could see it in my mom and dad, my grandmother.
Seeing his family so helpless in the face of his brother's death, Max made a decision that changed his life.
Maybe if I can become a physician, maybe it'll make a difference.
He did become a physician, and he is making a difference, not just for his own patients, but by advocating for changes that are affecting thousands of people in communities that need access to care. More than 63 million Latinos are living in the U.S. They are the largest racial or ethnic minority. In states like California, more than a quarter of Latinos speak Spanish at home, and many of them say they're not able to speak English very well. Language barriers often get in the way of quality health care, as do cultural barriers, and there's a shortage of physicians to serve this population. On this episode, we'll look at solutions in providing better care to Latino communities and patients. To get started, let's stick with the story of Max Cuevas, who decided to become a physician after his brother's death. Charlie Garcia picks up the story from here.
When Max first announced that he was going to become a doctor, no one really believed that this small-town Mexican kid could actually succeed.
I let classmates and the school teachers know, and they were sort of like, well, that's nice to have dreams, but don't worry if your dreams aren't fulfilled. I guess politely trying to tell me, yeah, right.
But the more he dreamed of becoming a doctor, the more he started to become aware of all the health issues the people around him were facing. One day, in a tent camp up in San Jose, he overheard a woman talking about her sickness. She was suffering from pain in the midsection and brought her daughter along to the doctor to translate.
The mom takes her daughter with her to translate because the mom couldn't speak English. And so the non-Hispanic white physician, he says, what can I do for you?
She tells her daughter she has dolor del bazo, pain of the spleen. But the daughter couldn't quite translate that. So she tells the doctor, well, my mom has a dollar in the glass. The girl didn't know the word for spleen in Spanish, bazo, and heard vaso, which means glass. And so, pain of the spleen, dolor del vaso, became dolor del vaso, a dollar in the glass. And so the doctor was lost, and he couldn't help the mother. Just a few towns away, another young Mexican-American boy was having a very similar experience.
I would go with my grandmother to translate to the doctor or my grandfather. Those were very personal experiences.
This boy's name was Arnaldo Torres, and neither he nor Max knew it at the time, but their paths were going to cross in a big way. Arnaldo was living in Sacramento, and he also was part of a Mexican-American family who made their living in the fields. And when he turned 10...
My grandfather told me that I was of the age in which I had to do la cosa cristiana, the Christian thing. And I asked him, Papi, what is that? And he says, you have to contribute to the well-being of the family. You have to work.
So he worked. And just like Max, Arnaldo spent countless hours as a child and teenager picking fruit in the fields until he was old enough to go out on his own. Arnaldo had his mind set on going to college. And so after getting a bachelor's degree in political science, he went far away from home, to Washington, D.C., to pursue a master's degree in public policy. And there, he experienced something completely new. At night, he would take walks on the Capitol grounds and reflect.
The Capitol is so beautiful at night with the way the lights are shined. And I remember telling myself, could you have imagined that you, the son and the grandson of farm workers, right now, in most instances, would be working in the fields, as opposed to walking on the grounds of the United States Capitol. It was truly an amazing feeling to never forget your roots, to see what was possible.
His goal was to work in politics and policy so he could help change things for those back home. But the path he'd chosen was not easy. Pursuing a career in public policy as the son of Mexican farm workers came along with some serious challenges.
You were always having to prove yourself. Always. It never stops. You get tired. You know, you would know some of the staff people would say, oh, here comes the Mexican. He's going to talk to us about Mexican issues.
And back in California, Max Cuevas was in medical school at UC San Francisco, having very similar issues.
You took exams like everybody else, and you got in based on your academic credential. Yeah, so why is it that students and faculty alike can tell you you don't belong there? Is it because of your name, a Latino name? Is it because of your color? You know, what is it?
After getting his master's degree in 1977, Arnaldo started working in D.C. with the League of United Latin American Citizens. He worked on immigration reform, civil rights, housing, all kinds of issues facing Latino communities. And in 1985, he decided to come back to California to advise local health clinics. Meanwhile, Max, who had completed his residency in OBGYN at UCLA and Kern Medical Center, had a choice to make. He could go pretty much anywhere in the country to practice, but he decided to stay and do what he had set out to do as a kid, serve his community. So in 1987, Max, now Dr. Cuevas, became the chief medical officer at a little health clinic in Salinas, California, serving a farmworking community just like the ones he'd grown up with. It's called Clínica de Salud del Valle de Salinas, or CSVS. The Salinas Valley, about an hour's drive south of San Francisco, is known as the salad bowl of the world. It produces a huge amount of the fruits and vegetables we eat. And because of this, it has one of the highest populations of farm workers in the whole country. Arnaldo was advising the CSVS clinic, and this is where he and Max finally met.
He and I were drawn to each other because we both worked in the fields. There was a very special bond. There's a solidarity between us because of these experiences as children.
They knew each other in a way that others couldn't, and they both shared the same burning passion to help the people in their communities. And in 1993, something happened that would change the fabric of these communities and bring the clinic where Max worked to a breaking point. NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Thank you very much. Just a few minutes ago, the House of Representatives voted to approve the North American Free Trade Agreement. NAFTA will expand our exports, create new jobs, and help us reassert America's leadership in the global economy. This agreement is in the deep south.
NAFTA removed trade tariffs between the U.S. and Mexico, which opened the door for heavily subsidized U.S. agriculture companies to export their crops south of the border way below cost in the Mexican market. And the result was devastating. Many local Mexican farmers lost virtually all of their income.
They panicked. They had to find employment. They started going to the big cities in Mexico. There weren't jobs there. So they turned to the United States, and we had a major inflow of undocumented workers. Our health centers were completely inundated.
The CSVS clinic where Max worked was totally overwhelmed. There were more and more farm workers coming from Mexico speaking Spanish and indigenous languages, but not enough doctors who knew the languages or the culture.
Those communities, I think, are hardest hit by the inability of physicians working there to be able to communicate and to understand also the culture, how it is that people perceive their illness, their disease.
Patients weren't able to understand the severity of their illnesses or how to treat them. And in many cases, this was leading to patients not getting any medical care at all. Max saw firsthand what was happening to patients who weren't able to receive treatment for illnesses like diabetes.
Blood vessels are shutting down, scarring up, you know, blocking off. Different body parts begin to malfunction to the point where they stop functioning. People wind up losing kidneys, going on dialysis, going blind, feet, toes getting cut off.
You must have trust with the doctor. When you can't communicate, you don't have the foundational element for trust.
Arnaldo and Max decided they had to do something. The two men had very different professional experiences, but complementary skills. Arnaldo knew how to handle policies and politics, while Max knew the medical side. So together, they set off on a mission to find more Spanish-speaking doctors. First, they tried to convince the California medical school system to simply add culture and language programs, but they hit a wall.
We could not get those people at all to make any changes. They refused to provide any classes in culture, any classes in language.
The medical school system in California was not interested.
We tried everything we could for at least 2 years with the UC system. And after the first year, we recognized that they weren't going to budge.
So in 1997, with the problem growing even worse, Arnaldo came up with a wild plan.
I came up with the idea that the only avenue that we had was to go outside and see if we could bring doctors in.
And I said, what do we need to do? Who do we need to talk to? He was excited. I was hell excited myself, thinking, wow, we can make this thing happen.
The idea was to create a program that would allow Mexican doctors to work in the U.S. for 3 years, in the areas that so desperately needed Spanish-speaking doctors. They were excited and ready to go, but the task ahead was monumental. To go south of the border and recruit doctors, they would need support from the U.S. and Mexican governments, California's Medical Board and Association, Mexican universities, and the California medical school system, which had already been so difficult to breach. It seemed impossible. But without any other options, they pressed ahead.
We realized and understood it's going to be a hard fight, but we're in it to win.
I knew it was going to be a formidable initiative because of who we had against us, which was everybody. I mean everybody.
We're listening to a story reported by Charlie Garcia. He is a producer with a podcast called In Confianza from Pulso. Coming up, Max and Arnaldo score a big win just to find themselves hitting a wall.
Oh, the anger, the frustration, all the suffering that our population is going through because they can't access medical care.
But they're not ready to give up. That's still to come on The Pulse.
Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Amgen, a biotechnology pioneer leading the fight against the world's toughest diseases such as cancer, heart disease, asthma, and osteoporosis. In a new era of human health, Amgen continues to accelerate the pace of change, operating sustainably and drawing upon deep knowledge of science to push beyond what's known today. With each decade, they reliably deliver powerful new therapies to patients. Learn more at Amgen.com.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Progressive. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit their website to get a quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, and their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. Then just choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're listening to a story about an effort to improve medical care for Spanish-speaking patients in the U.S., especially people who work in farming and already face a lot of barriers in accessing care. In the late 1990s, physician Max Cuevas and public policy expert Arnoldo Torres had teamed up around a bold new idea to bridge the language gap in medical care. Bring Mexican physicians to California to practice there for three-year terms. They figured they would face some resistance from lawmakers and healthcare providers, but the pushback also came from surprising corners. Reporter Charlie Garcia picks up the story from here.
Max and Arnoldo knew their idea to recruit doctors from Mexico would be a tough sell, but they didn't realize just how tough.
I was surprised by Latino physicians and Latino physician groups that were against the program. In fact, one of them dubbed the program a Mexican Bracero doctor program.
The Bracero program was a now infamous initiative that brought Mexican farm workers to the U.S. to support agriculture during and after the Second World War. But many Braceros were cheated and abused by employers and exposed to harmful pesticides, which gave the program a bad name. This, of course, was nothing like that. But still, people had all kinds of pushback. Some argued that Mexican doctors were substandard compared to American doctors.
Clearly, they did not understand how insulting and offensive that concept and that statement was. But that is the argument they gave.
Others argued that this program would be replacing or taking the jobs of U.S. Latino doctors, that it was a form of competition.
There's so much need in healthcare out there, especially in low-income communities. You can bring a lot of physicians and you're still not going to scratch the surface.
And others just didn't like the idea itself. But after three long years of meetings, of advocating and talking to hundreds of people, they succeeded to get it on a bill in the California legislature. And guess what? It passed. Bill AB 1045 was signed into law by then-Governor Gray Davis in September of 2002. But this was just the beginning.
The easy part is done.
Because there were so many fears about the Mexican doctors not being up to par, part of the bill specified that they would do an orientation program with the UC school system that would help the new doctors integrate into the American medical system. The next big hurdle was to get the UC school system to follow through.
We went to them thinking that they're going to embrace the program. And then when they came out and told us flat out in our face that they wanted nothing to do with this program, that to begin with, doctors from Mexico are inferior.
We could not implement it because there was no UC medical school that wanted to cooperate. It just languished. Oh, the anger, the frustration, all the suffering that our population is going through because they can't access medical care.
I reached out to UC Medical School to ask about this. They told me in an email that, quote, the University of California did not take a position opposing AB 1045, end quote. They added that they strongly support the goals of the legislation. Max says there was no support when they first tried to launch the program, which was a big blow, but he tried to stay optimistic.
I didn't think it was over. I just thought, let's take a deep breath, you know, let's go to halftime. Let's regroup, change our game plan, and let's go out and give them hell.
By this point, they were exhausted, and their careers were already demanding enough. The program was put on hold. Months turned into years, and time went on. But the farm workers still worked. They still got sick. They still couldn't understand doctors. They still suffered. The clinics tried to make it work with interpreters, but there were nowhere near enough. And even when they did find one, the nuances of doctor-patient conversations would often get lost in the translation. It just didn't work. And as time went on, more and more migrant workers came to harvest and pack the food that feeds the country. And the lack of Spanish-speaking doctors grew even more dire. By 2015, Max's clinic in Salinas was completely overwhelmed. So he picked up the phone and made a call to his old friend.
He called me up and he said, "Is this project still accessible? Can we still implement it?" And I said, "Yes, we can." He goes, "Well, let's try it again."
They decided to give their effort to bring Mexican doctors to the U.S. one more shot. But this time, they had a new idea to get the physicians evaluated. They decided to try and work with a local hospital. They chose Natividad Medical Center, right next door in Salinas.
We went to them and said, "Would you be willing to sponsor the orientation program?"
It took lots of meetings and some negotiating, but in the end,
we were absolutely so pleased that it was unanimous, and the interest by the board in supporting this was beyond anything that we could have expected.
So in early August of 2021, the first of 30 Mexican doctors got on a plane and flew to California.
August the 9th was the first day the doctor began to see patients.
Then another 10 came in March, 10 more in September, 7 more in January. Little by little, the doctors started to trickle in.
Mucho gusto en saludarla otra vez. Bueno, me quedo ahorita, pues ya para el día de hoy, ya tenemos.
This is Dr. Armando Moreno, an OBGYN from Mexico City. Today, he's seeing a patient for a checkup at the Clinic de Salud's Sanborn location. She's 33 weeks pregnant. He chats comfortably with her and looks at the patient kindly as he asks what the name of the baby will be.
¿Cómo se va a llamar?
Se va a llamar Isabela.
Isabela. Muy bien, pues vamos a hablarle como entonces. Isabela, nuestra querida Isabela.
All the news is good. Isabella weighs 1,850 grams. She's healthy and kicking.
My first day here, I was really scared. To be honest, I was really scared.
In 2016, he got a call from his supervisor in Mexico City telling him about a program.
He told me, "Hey, I have this invitation for you. I met these guys, Arnoldo, Dr. Cuevas, and I think this work fits with you."
His whole body lit up with excitement.
Sometimes in our lifetime, we have these moments when you feel like this burning sensation inside your heart, when you know that something's going to change.
And this was one of those moments.
I said, "I can't miss this opportunity. I need to be part of it."
He applied, then waited 6 whole years until finally in July 2022, he got the news. He and his wife quit their jobs, moved out of the house, and boarded a plane to San Francisco with their two cats to start their new adventure.
You enter to the room, of course the patient is waiting for you, and you enter. When you say these words in Spanish, you can notice in the patient's eyes this small smile, and you know that the patient is comfortable. You know that the patient is happy.
As happy as one can be at the doctor's office.
You build this bridge between you and your patient. There's a lot of unconscious background, mutual understanding, like this empathy. There's like a sublime, subconscious communication between people from the same culture.
Sí, 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 se siente estrés porque te hablan y no sabes qué contestar, pues no entiendes.
This is Blanca, one of Armando's patients at the clinic.
Y aquí la verdad que sí. Donde vas, simplemente para hacer las citas. A mí se me hacía al principio bien difícil, pero no, yo ahorita y aquí ya me siento como pez en el agua, porque siempre hay alguien que te va a contestar en español.
Blanca is saying how, in the past, it's been so stressful for her to go to the doctor, that she doesn't understand what the doctors are saying or how she should respond. Even making the appointment is difficult. But now she feels so comfortable here at the clinic.
Tengo poco viéndola, pero sí. Sí, y te da esa confianza también ella.
Blanca has such a strong level of trust with Armando that she feels like he's her psychologist.
People here, most of them have really difficult experiences in their lives, in their past. I've heard terrible, terrible stories about crossing the border, crossing the Guatemala-Mexico border. I mean, people struggle so much to be here.
As an OBGYN, Armando sees many, many women who've been sexually assaulted along their journey. Teenagers tell stories of being separated from their parents. Women and men open up about abuse, depression, and anxiety in their lives.
I think that it's this opportunity we have to try to help them to open their hearts and to speak openly about it. This is the first step for healing.
A lot of those patients now say, for the first time, I understand what the hell is going on with my illness. And then they ask me, why did the doctors not tell us that before? And I tell them, well, you probably didn't understand.
Today, there are 30 doctors in the program. Each of them will serve for 3 years and be able to help hundreds of Spanish-speaking patients before returning back to Mexico. The goal is to have even more doctors, dentists, and psychiatrists take part in the program in the coming years. An updated version of the bill aims to have over 200 doctors by 2036. But it's important to note that while AB 1045 is making a huge impact in people's lives, the scope of the problem is too big for one program to handle. Here's Arnaldo.
It's a Band-Aid. It was never intended to be the answer. It was intended to provide time for the UC system to take on greater responsibility.
The scope of the problem is huge, and this program can't fix everything. But for Max, for Arnaldo, and all the Mexican doctors, there's a victory in every single visit where a person who felt alone can see that they have someone on their side.
We have medical science, but we also have to take care about what they believe, what they fear. We need to take care of the human part.
Health isn't only about medicine or treatments. It doesn't just mean that one's body is free from pain or injury. It's also the need to be seen, to be heard. And as these Mexican doctors are learning, it's the need to be understood that beats at the heart of human health.
This story was reported and produced by Charlie Garcia in collaboration with the podcast In Confianza from Pulso, which tells stories about finding belonging in the experience of being Latino in the U.S. The collaboration is part of a reporting initiative supported by the Commonwealth Fund. Additional field reporting by Jackie Nowak and additional audio editing by Julian Blackmore. Special thanks to Eric Lopez, Myra Pantoja, and the staff at Clínica de Salud de Valle de Salinas. We're talking about health issues affecting Latino communities and solutions for better care. Gun violence is on the rise among Latinos in the U.S. From 2014 to 2020, the number of Hispanic Americans who died because of gun violence rose by over 60%. And for survivors, there's often a difficult road ahead. Reporter Aitana Vargas has been looking into the long-term impact of gun violence on Latinos and what resources, especially mental health resources, are available to help them cope.
It really has a ripple effect over the course of someone's life. You know, some survivors lose their jobs and their income and the ability to take care of themselves. And the problem is that usually there is no long-term support.
Aitana found that many rely on their families for support and care. She's been talking to Latino gun violence survivors across the country and organizations that try to serve them. You met the family of David Rodriguez, a Latino man who was shot in a road rage incident in Arizona 45 years ago. And this incident continues to affect his family. So what happened?
Well, I mean, the fact that David got shot turned his life and his family's life upside down. He was paralyzed by the bullet. And he had to relocate from Arizona to California and move in with his parents so they could take care of him. Also, his father had to work very long hours as he was approaching retirement age because the family needed more money to get by and to pay outstanding medical bills. Eventually, 16 years later, David took his own life.
The tragic events had a profound emotional impact on the entire family and their well-being. Aitana spoke with David's sister, Helen. Here's an excerpt from their conversation.
David was 27 when he was shot and paralyzed. He was in the hospital for about 9 months, and his bills back 40 years ago were more than $1 million. Health insurance paid 80%, but a lot of things aren't covered. Counseling isn't covered. My parents had to drop their whole lives to take care of their disabled adult son. David lost his income because he could no longer work. And our lives were so profoundly different. We were left entirely alone. There were no community organizations. There was no victims' compensation.
Helen said that if the family had had more help providing care for her brother and emotional support, things might have turned out very differently.
My brother might not have killed himself after 16 years. My mom died of pancreatic cancer at 63. 8 years after David got shot? You know, would my mother have lived a longer life if she didn't have this incredible stress?
In her reporting, Aitana also found that many victims of gun violence continue to face similar barriers today. You also spoke to Diego Lopez, a man who lives in Hartford, Connecticut, who faced sort of a similar downward spiral after getting shot multiple times. What happened to Diego?
So Diego Lopez grew up in a very dysfunctional family without a father figure, and he experienced multiple episodes of domestic violence that contributed to his anger outbursts and very poor life choices. And this actually included his involvement in gangs at a very young age. As a teenager, you know, when he was like 16, 17 years old, he was shot.
So I remember the first time I was shot as a young person. I didn't want to talk to the police at the time, you know, because I at the time I was young. I was in the streets. I didn't know if I had warrants. So I ended up jumping out the window in the ER. I hopped out the window and just ran.
Diego was very hesitant to get any kind of medical treatment because he was worried about being caught by police due to his gang activity with the Latin Kings. Over the course of the years, he ended up getting arrested, getting shot 3 other times, and he also ended up with huge medical bills.
I had medical insurance, so I did pay for a portion of the bill. But if you're shot, you're not working, now you're not paying bills, you're not paying your rent. All those things could definitely trickle down to like a spiral or a spinning cycle for a human being.
Eventually, Diego served 16 years in prison and he was separated from his daughter, which took an emotional toll on him and made him reconsider his life choices. At some point, he realized that he was going down the wrong path in life. But luckily, he was offered a lifeline by a nonprofit called Compass.
I've took so much from my community, right? I can now give back to my community.
He became a volunteer here and started helping out minors and young adults, mostly Black and Latino youth, who are currently experiencing a similar situation as he did decades ago.
Some of these kids, when they get shot, I pick them up for their appointments, I take them to the hospital, and I do it because ain't nobody did that for me. Nobody.
So this organization that Diego is working for now, Compass, they are based in Hartford, Connecticut. What kind of support do they provide for people?
Well, Mike, and some of the services they provide speak to very basic needs. And here's their CEO, Jacqueline Santiago Nazario.
Not knowing how to pack a wound. We've had instances where bullets have fallen out of people's legs, you know, in the shower. They don't have any idea what to do in these instances. And they call us. Rather than the hospital, they call us.
Jacqueline says that money becomes a major barrier for accessing physical and mental health care for many Latinos. Her organization tries to provide assistance and to address the mental health needs, but Aitana found out that can be challenging.
According to some of the experts that I talked to, this is a main challenge for Latinos, given that there is a lot of stigma attached to seeking and getting any kind of mental health assistance. But another thing that I would like to highlight is that other factors that prevent Latinos from getting the treatment and help that they need include the language barrier and the fear of deportation, especially for those who are undocumented.
What are some potential solutions that you have come across in your reporting, other than organizations like the one we just talked about that address this issue in a culturally competent kind of way?
So some of the experts that I talked to mentioned that many Latino gun owners don't store guns safely. So you actually need better education campaigns when it comes to gun safety, and also when it comes to normalizing mental health support, which can be crucial to someone's healing process. You know, experts believe that culture plays a huge role in the recovery process and the kind of assistance that different communities are going to need. As a matter of fact, when I was talking to some of the experts, one of the things they pointed out to is that Latino communities are very diverse. So the needs of each community are going to differ from one another. Right? Like, for instance, if we're thinking in terms of like Latin American communities, I'm going to give you an example. Argentina, you're going to find people who are completely okay with seeking any kind of mental health support. But if you talk to people from Mexico or other communities, that is not going to be the case. So yeah, there is, you know, a common denominator, which is language, but tradition, culture, and what is normally and socially acceptable by your peers and your family goes a long way when it comes to seeking the support that you need in a situation like gun violence.
As you dove into gun violence as a specific health issue affecting the, quote, Latino community, even though, as you just said, it's a very diverse community, but is this an issue that people recognize as a big problem in this community, or is this just not really rising to the top of concerns here?
I think a lot of people in the Latino community fear coming forward. And I have to go back to the fact that when we are talking about Latinos in the U.S., there are a lot of undocumented people. So that's going to be a huge barrier when it comes to coming forward with issues and problems that they need assistance for. But sadly, you know, if we look at, you know, gun violence in the United States and some of the school shootings, including what happened in Uvalde, Texas in 2022, you know, obviously forces gun violence to the political agenda and into the conversation. But that doesn't mean necessarily that enough is being done to address the problem.
That's Aitana Vargas. Her reporting was done in collaboration with Palabra, a multimedia platform and initiative of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. We had audio production assistance from Alan Hinnage. You can find Aitana's story on our website, whyy.org/thepulse, and we'll link to a Spanish language version as well. Coming up,
at Stanford, about 40% of our patients are Hispanic Latina. The majority are immigrants. And I'm the only physician in my division that is trained to speak Spanish to patients.
We'll meet a doctor who is trying to change those statistics. That's next on The Pulse.
On NPR's Throughline,
we cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
On It's Been a Minute, we're keeping you in the know when it comes to culture. I break down the latest trends and the forces behind them and introduce you to the creatives who think deeply about how we live today. Come for some good old cultural analysis and have a few laughs with me. Listen to the It's Been a Minute podcast from NPR.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about providing better medical care to Latino communities and patients.
I'm going to tell you a story because this is really my love for medicine.
That's physician Cesar Padilla.
So my first night on call at Stanford was on labor and delivery. I spoke Spanish to almost every single patient.
Cesar is an obstetric anesthesiologist at Stanford Medicine. He says the fact that he is Mexican-American, a son of working-class immigrants, makes a big difference for his patients.
At Stanford, about 40% of our patients are Hispanic Latina. The majority are immigrants. And I'm the only physician in my division that is trained to speak Spanish to patients, that is qualified to speak Spanish to patients. And it felt incredibly special to be able to connect with patients. And let's say someone's having a C-section, they're scared, they don't understand the language, and I'm able to break down those barriers and play, like, for example, I could play music. If they're from Mexico, I could play music from Mexico. And you just see the anxiety melt away.
Yeah. And what do they say when you speak Spanish to them? Are they totally surprised?
Not really, because I walk in and I usually wear a soccer jacket over my scrubs, and the soccer jackets are like either Mexico or a Mexican soccer team.
Yeah. Right.
Which
is a clue.
By the way, is like, to me, that's a sign of professionalism, which is interesting because we're trained to think that professionalism is a white coat. Well, what if what you wear connects with patients? That's professional. So, so I wear my soccer jacket with the soccer team, and they recognize right away. And if I'm not wearing it that day, I just start speaking Spanish. And yeah, you can see it in their eyes. You can see the fear go away.
But the path to becoming a physician was challenging.
There was no mentors that I can identify with, meaning I had never met a Latino or Latina physician from my community. There was no examples. So how do you do something that you've never seen? It's very psychologically difficult.
Cesar grew up in Union City, California, but the inspiration to pursue medicine really came from the summers he spent in Mexico.
That's where I got a lot of my motivation, because in the United States, life was difficult. Being raised in a working class environment, there was a lot of gangs, there was a lot of social stressors. Our classrooms were not really set up for a learning environment. They were overcrowded. And so my inspiration for becoming a physician came from my experiences in Mexico, because there I felt really this sort of social support. And I also saw physicians there who were in the community, who were serving people. I think it was those experiences in Mexico that really ignited the fire, the passion, the love for medicine, the love for humanity.
And what were some of the challenges you faced, especially early on, as you tried to get on the path toward medical school?
I was raised in a working class community. My mother was a breadwinner. She worked in a local factory in Union City, California, 30 minutes away from Stanford. She had to cash her 401k to help me pay for medical school expenses. So think about that. You have someone who's working class, who wants to become a doctor, and you have to go to these extreme lengths. A mother should never have to cash her 401k for her son to pay for the MCAT, which is the medical college admissions test, the exam to get into medical school. So there was the financial barrier. And then the social barrier around in my surroundings, there was a lot of violence. I had friends that were murdered. I had friends who ended up in prison. And it's not because we were innately bad kids, it's because the environment we were raised in, there was drugs around. My neighbors basically sold drugs. And so I was raised in an environment where every day there was a real threat. So I think those are the biggest stressors and the biggest obstacles in me becoming a physician.
He says these challenges are common and they are keeping a lot of Latinos out of medicine. Right now, about 6% of U.S. physicians are Latino. And in California, they serve a population that is 40% Latino. Cesar is trying to lower the barriers for other Latinos to become physicians. Together with a friend who is also a doctor, Michael Galvez, he started an initiative called National Latino Physician Day. It happens on October 1st. One aspect of it is for Latino physicians to post on social media on that day to show strength in numbers. But it goes beyond that.
It's not just a day to, you know, kumbaya. We are pressing institutions, hospitals, and medical schools to increase Latino physician representation. We are putting the spotlight on medical schools that have frankly failed. They have failed in increasing the number of Latino physicians when compared to our patient population.
And what are some things that would have to change those numbers? Like, what is this pressure going to hopefully do?
I want to take this time to highlight Dr. Joaquin Arambula, who was an assembly member from California. Dr. Joaquin Arambula came to Stanford to celebrate National Latino Physician Day, and he asked that very same question that you're asking. We told Dr. Joaquin Arambula, we need to celebrate and to honor bilingual medical school applicants, because if you speak Spanish or another language that is in need in California, medical schools should be able to quantify that and say, hey, that matters as much as, let's say, your MCAT score. That matters as much as your research experience, because as of now, bilingual skills are not formally taken into account when someone is applying to medical school, which is unfortunate because 44% of California households speak another language other than English. Mm. So Dr. Joaquin Arambula then wrote Bill 2080, which is inspired by this conversation. And the bill would require University of California and private medical schools to give admissions preference to applicants who speak underrepresented languages in the physician workforce when compared to the population. So that is Spanish, Vietnamese, Thai, Tagalog. And that is currently in the legislature in California.
Have you come up with any ideas, any solutions that could address some of the financial barriers that are huge for a lot of people? I mean, just the tests alone that you have to take, you mentioned them earlier, they can cost hundreds and hundreds of dollars. And then if you can't pay for a prep course to prepare for it, your chances are already lower. So what about those kinds of issues?
There's a program in California. It's called the California Med Scholars Program. And this program has received $12 million from the state of California. And what this program does is it strengthens the pipeline between community colleges, which is where the majority of Latino and Black students in California go to receive their education and where low-income students go. So it strengthens the pipeline between community colleges and medical schools. And this is an example of how government-funded infrastructure can help low-income community college students become doctors. I myself am a product of the community college system. Dr. Michael Galvez himself is a product of the community college system. And so this program, California Med Scholars Program, is an excellent example of proactive legislation as well.
What do you hope for the next Physicians Day and the ones to come after that? Like, what's kind of your big vision for this?
National Latino Physician Day has now been introduced to the National Senate and the House of Representatives as a day to be recognized. So what we're going to do next year is hopefully that passes and that day is recognized. This is going to go national. And we want to take this up to, you know, Governor Gavin Newsom, even the White House. Let's go to the president. If it's already in the House, it's already in the Senate, let's take these conversations up, because this is a healthcare crisis. 6% of U.S. physicians being Latino in a state like California, where 40% of the patient population is Latino, is simply not enough. And in the U.S. in the year 2050, roughly 1 in 3 Americans are going to be of Latino background. This is a crisis. And to give you some numbers, in California during the COVID pandemic, 70%, 7 out of 10 women who were pregnant and died of COVID were Hispanic. 70% of women that died during the COVID pandemic that were pregnant and had COVID were Hispanic. That is absolutely devastating. And so what we need are initiatives to help bridge those gaps. We need medical schools to look at their communities and say, hey, if a lot of our patients that are suffering worse healthcare outcomes are coming from these low-income communities, then we should build pipeline programs to create physicians from those same communities, because those students are going to understand what it's like to be in that community and help us come up with solutions to decrease disparities, because this is going to save lives. This is about patients first.
Cesar Padilla is a Mexican-American obstetric anesthesiologist at Stanford Medicine, and he's the co-founder of National Latino Physician Day. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia, made possible with support from our founding sponsor, the Sutherland Family, and the Commonwealth Fund. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Grant Hill. Alan Hinnich is the project manager for our collaborations around Latino health. Marcus Biddle is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. And this week we had additional engineering from Al Banks. Our producers are Nicole Curry and Lindsay Lazarski. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Okay, close your eyes for a second. Now imagine you're on your dream vacation. No work calls to answer, no text messages to respond to, just your suitcase and an opportunity.
The opportunity to just take yourself out of your routine and travel deeper.
How to actually take that dream trip. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest-growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.